pulling out of Haynesville's past.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, well, now this was the next series of questions that I wanted to...
No, wait a minute. Do you want me to tell you about that, how he got away with that watering of the stock in Crown Point?
Yeah.
This was in 1948. Daddy was superintendent. They sent him to Crown Point, hoping he'd go away, you know, but he didn't go away. He stayed about 2 years at Crown Point. And Mother came on to Albuquerque. Mother had all of that she could tolerate. She was finished. She moved. She came to Albuquerque. So I stayed with Dad. And I went into his office one day, and he was just white. He was so mad. His face was as white as his hair. And I was always a little worried for him, you know, because he took these things so personally. He just used to get so upset when the Navajo was stepped on. And I got the story that he wanted to water, he wanted to haul water to the dipping vats and water at the local watering spot. Dipping vats were usually the local spots in this Crown Point area. He wanted to haul water from the wells to the local spot and distribute water so that the sheep wouldn't die, because they were flat going to die. It was that dry. And he called Windrock, and they said they could not authorize it. It would have to go through Washington. And of course, anything that goes through Washington, you know how long that sort of thing takes. So he was just livid. He was just beside himself. So we went home and we had lunch, and he began to walk, and he began to whistle, and you could see this forming in his mind, what he was going to do. So he stepped to the telephone in the hall, and he called Windrock, the garages this time. And he ordered, I don't know how many dozen trucks, and he called the whatever warehouse it was, and he ordered watering troughs and watering tanks, and he told him to be there the next morning, that he had authority from Washington to do it. And the next morning, the trucks and the troughs and the barrels, or the you know, the big tank that they put on trucks, rolled in. And for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, went on longer than that, it went on about 6 weeks, Daddy hauled water to the different locations, and the Indians would bring their sheep in, and they watered. Now, he didn't permit them to water all their horses, but he did permit them to water their sheep and some of their horses. I know that this was quite a hang-up, because, you know, they think as much of their horses as they do their sheep. But he was primarily interested in saving those sheep. Then he came home one day at noon, just whistling and laughing, and he said, you know, I finally got permission from Washington to start watering this livestock. But you see, this was the frustration he was faced with. Had he been a typical bureau man of Indian affairs, he wouldn't have done this. And no telling how many herd of sheep would have died.
This was in 1948?
Dan, it was about 1947, 1948. You can check that out with the weather and things at that time. Because I was married in spring of 1949, so it was 1948 and 1949, somewhere in that 47, 48, 49, right in that area somewhere. So this was the kind of thing that, this is a prime example of the kind of thing that Daddy was always doing.
Do you think we could persuade your father to tell us more of these
extra-legal
maneuverings?
All the things he did were extra-legal. Mm-hmm. Now, like he used to, when I was a child, we had, She Dodge used to come, of course, all of us will tell you this story, how he used to come and visit at our house. I mean, he was just there a lot of the time. And I think many of my opinions of Navajo folklore were formed in my mind from Chi Dodge and Howard Gorman, and these men were always at our house. But we always served them drinks. Daddy always drank with them in the kitchen. They always had drinks. There was no such thing as a drunken Navajo. I mean, but they drank sociably, like you and I would drink. And then, every 2 or 3 weeks or so, we'd gather up all the liquor bottles and take them out down the arroyo and dig a hole and bury them. Because it was illegal. Those are the impressions that are made on a child's mind.
Okay, this is another series of questions I wanted to get into. But before we branch off there into that,
mm-hmm.
We've got him to Fort Defiance with a presidential appointment.
Mm-hmm.
which I gather continues. It's either renewed every year or he just keeps it until he gives it up, and he stays at either Fort Defiance or Crown Point until when?
He retired in 1950. I was married in 1949 in May. And Dad stayed. Of course, you see, then he was alone. Horace and I moved to White Rock, which is a trading post about 30 miles north of Crown Point, almost in the Bisti area where Daddy and Mother originally homesteaded. And he was far too lonely. It was just too much. I mean, but he stayed because at that time he was working on a ranch, and I can't tell you which ranch, that the tribe later bought. And he was waiting to get this deal finished, and he finished it. And the morning that he finished this and he was through, he simply put his suitcase in the car and drove off. He didn't tell anybody goodbye. He didn't tell them he was quitting. He didn't write a letter of resignation. He didn't do anything. He got in the car and left.
Can you give me a month on that?
I can't, Dan, but I can find it out for you. But you see, he'd been building for this for a long time.
But you're pretty sure it was 1950?
I would guess it was, I think he stayed past January of that year. And that, let's check out with him. I'll ask him which ranch it was at that time he was selling. I don't know whether it was Ed Sargent's ranch or just what it was. But you see, Dad was a friend of all those ranchers in that part of the world. All the Indian traders and the Indians. The only people he was always at odds with was the government service. But he was always at odds with the government service, because he didn't go by the rules.
Well, the government service, of course, has
many areas
taken a lot of criticism.
Uh-huh.
And it's, some of it is certainly a result of the fact that it is so large and unwieldy, like any government organization, even the service, the military services.
Right.
It just cannot operate efficiently because of its size.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that we want to, I'll try to stress this with your father, I think we want to try to be as impartial as we can in making judgments, because I think there should be judgments, but they should be as well thought out as possible, because I think when you stay close to something like that and you build up an antagonism,
right,
and you don't get away from it to appraise your own point of view, you cannot see why there was this conflict between the government people and somebody like your father.
Well, now, one of the distinct impressions I had as a child, and I still feel this, and I was very astounded to hear a young woman put it into words just last Saturday. I went to a kindergarten association meeting here all day Saturday, and there was a young girl in from Tohatchee. She's teaching the Head Start program at Tohatchee, and something was said about it, and I told her I knew where Tohatchee was, and of course we struck up a conversation, and she said, "I am so frustrated teaching there," and I asked her why, and she said, "So many of the teachers that are out there really do not like the Navajo people," and I was just kind of crushed, because I thought maybe that feeling had gone away, you know. I was hoping that the people that are working with the Navajos now are maybe a little more educated and a little more tolerant toward the Navajo people themselves. But the impression that I have from a child, and I know this is true because I live too close to the Navajo people. I mean, I was too good a friend to the Navajos themselves, the Navajo children, was that most of the government service people in the little community of Crown Point, and certainly in the community of Fort Defiance, looked upon the Navajo people as really a second-class citizen. Not even that.
Do you know why? Was this a reasoned point of view?
They... Well, I always just kind of chalked it up to ignorance. I felt that they never tried to understand. They were dirty, you know. I can remember them saying things like, we'd take off, there was a graveyard up in back of the boys' building where the old soldiers had been buried from the original fort that was at Fort Defiant. And some of the tombstones up there were terribly interesting, you know. We used to go always back up in there. And I can remember Mother saying to Daddy, now you must stop Robbie from going up there. She's going to have lice, and she's going to have all this business that the Navajos have. Now this was Mama. And Mother was not as tolerant, as I say, as Dad and I were. But, and then in the schools, they put the Navajo children all together in one part of the room because they smelled a little different, you know, and they did. I mean, in the first place, these children from from the mission, they're the Good Shepherd Mission, they smelled a little like disinfectant, you know. And the children, the Navajo children from the employees' children, there were Navajo employees, you know, people like would work in the powerhouse and where else, in the garages and things like this. They were Navajo parents. They were just really kind of dirty. And I think they felt they were dirty, ignorant people.
Well, now, in other words, what you're saying is that some of the bias was based on a comparison between the cleanliness of the whites, supposedly,
yeah,
and the uncleanliness of the Navajo.
Right.
Well, did you have the same feelings about the Navajo themselves being dirty?
Heck no. I liked the way they smelled.
You really didn't?
I really
didn't.
It didn't
bother you at all?
Not at all.
But they did have lice, and they did smell differently.
Yes, they did. They didn't have water to bathe with like we do.
And when you went to a hogan, did you watch where you sat? So, and did you check yourself for lice?
I never did. And I used to always go to the sheep dips. Daddy had two men. One's name was John, and one's name was Buck Martinez. I was talking this over with Daddy the other night, and I said, Daddy, I really think Mama didn't like me. How come I spent so much time on the truck with those men? They would freight the things to the different sheep dips. See, that was Daddy's job. They started the dipping of scabies.
You mean freight the cans of pesticide?
Yeah, and the wire and the troughs and things like that. So I went with these men a lot of the time. And we would arrive at sheep dips where Daddy wasn't even at. I would be alone with them. And I would get down out of the truck and go eat the mutton and the fried bread or whatever it was that the Indians were eating. And they just accepted me, I guess, as one of their own. But I think I'm the only one of the family that did, except with the exception of my brother. And Buford worked with Daddy dipping the sheep. So I was, and at the time I'm saying this, I must have been, I would imagine I was 8, 9, 10.
But you don't recall in the, 21 years you were there, that feeling any of the same kind of holier-than-thou attitude that we think is identifiable with most of the government service employees?
No, I didn't, and I think the reason I didn't, I think the reason I didn't was because of the really, truly great Navajo men that spent so much time in our kitchen.
Was there a variation in degrees of dirt? I mean, a man like Chi Dodge, who was so well known and so well respected generally in both Navajo and white circles, and probably J.C. Morgan and Howard Gorman, they were, mm-hmm, there were certainly, if we can say there were classes, and I think there are among the Navajo, there were certainly upper class.
Yeah.
Well, now, did they wear the same kinds of clothes? Did they seem to need a bath? Did they also have lice?
I don't know. I never got lice. There's a story that a Navajo louse won't live on a white